Well, welcome back to this Energy for Metallurgy seminar. So we will now have a talk by Christian Bros from E.ON in Germany. So we'll not go into the details of his bio, which is available in the program book. You can read it if you want, but mainly Christian is the lead metallurgist at E.ON Global Commodities in Düsseldorf. And he focuses especially on short to medium run weather forecast for power and gas trading. Christian, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Laurent. Can you hear me now? Is it? Okay, much better. Thanks for the introduction. I'm happy to be here and thankful for the opportunity to speak to you about weather and climate impacts on the energy sector, which will keep us busy for the next hour. First of all, I want to give you an overview of the different components of the energy sector, then see how weather impacts the supply side of the energy world, how it impacts the demand side, and then what is connecting those two worlds, that's the energy markets. And we leave the weather timescale and go out a little bit longer and see how climate will affect the whole business. You could, of course, think about different ways of approaching this topic, how you try to structure the energy sector, which was a quite wide topic for me to tackle. I thought, if you're thinking about supply, meaning the ability to deliver any sort of energy-related ready-to-use product to meet the demand, which is on the other side, and then put markets, transportation, grids, and anything else in between, that should be quite fair approach. On the supply side, of course, we've got electric power. That's what most people think about when talking to or about the energy sector. On the other hand, you've got other things related to this as well. Think of oil, think of gas, think of liquefied natural gas, just to name a few. And the demand side should be quite clear. It's the demand for this specific product in a certain region at a given point of time, and the hard task is to meet these quite exactly, as we've heard from Laurent before. It's a matter not only of long-term planning, but can go up to like the last seconds or a few seconds to keep the frequency stable, so it's a quite big thing to work on. I will focus a little bit on coal and to use it for producing electric power. There's a couple of examples I will give to you. First of all, I would like your input to get this a bit more interactive. What do you think how the different parameters you probably all know quite well are affecting the different sides of the energy balance, so the supply side and the demand side? If there's anybody volunteering to speak up, I would be happy. I thought so. Thanks a lot, guys. So we will keep this blank, and I'll come back to that later on. Maybe you look at it for a couple of more seconds. Keep it in mind and at least make up your mind on your own what you think and could imagine, and then later on see if what you thought about is right or not. So we're starting with weather impacts on the supply side, and of course on the supply side I want to start with a direct example. The probably most easy one is wind generation. This is the power curve you see here of a classical wind turbine. You've got the wind speed at hub height on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is the produced power of the wind turbine. As most of you probably know, with no wind, there's no generation possible, full stop. First thing to keep in mind. Second thing to keep in mind, if there's too much wind, which depending on the model you're using is roughly about 25 meters per second of wind speed at hub height, you get stall effects on the blades, which will cause the whole wind system to shut down. There's no generation left either. We've got a relatively small band of 15 to 25 meters per second where we've got maximum generation. And then it'll again depend on if your wind is blowing steadily, if it's more gusty situation, you might be facing some issues there then. And there is the most critical range, which is around 10 meters per second. As you can see, that's where the power curve ramps up heavily. So just a little mismatch in your wind speed forecast will have a big effect later on the power output. And as Laurent said, I'm coming from the energy trading business. A mismatch means losing money heavily. And that is something you as meteorologists should keep in mind. So what you want to know when talking about wind and its impact on the power supply is, will there be wind or not? When will it start? How long is it going to be? How strong is it going to blow? Is it steady or not? And when will it end again? And then something maybe to keep in mind, the blades of such a windmill, you can compare to the wings of an airplane. And if you've got icing, usually these things tend to fall down from the sky. Now, fortunately, this is not the case with wind turbines, but they shut down as well because you get stall effects, even though you don't have enough wind speed to cause it. But the profile of the blade won't work anymore if you attach ice to it. So this is something which does not happen too often, but which you should keep in mind as well. And the next example is getting a little bit more complex already. What you see here is the power output of a solar panel depending on the system's temperature. I'm not talking about the surrounding air temperature, but about the system, the panel temperature of the solar panel. And what you see is that the warmer it gets, the earlier is the outage. And roughly, as a rule of thumb, you got 2.3% of loss in efficiency per 5 degrees warmer. That's quite a bit. And if you imagine how hot a black solar panel can get, it's easily 70 or more centigrades, then you're getting into a range where you usually should not assume more than 70% of the installed capacity actually to deliver to the market, even though you might have clear sky conditions in summer with high radiation. The ideal world would be a combination of Arctic cold air in summer. That would be perfect, which we want to have. It's not too often the case, so we have to live with this and see that we get a reduction. And this should be also on your mind when forecasting for the energy business, which I think is part of the seminar. Of course, there's other stuff as well. I should not forget about that. It's the classical one everybody's thinking about. If you've got clear sky conditions and then the frontal system is moving in, it's bringing clouds, you should, of course, get the timing right. It's just like with the wind generation where you need the ramping hours first. It's the same here. You've got an installed capacity in a certain region. When it does it start to be covered with clouds? So you get a reduction in generation. And on the other hand, if there's fog, when will it disappear? Will it disappear at all? Do you trust your models? Do you disregard them? That's up to you. This is something which you should make up your mind about when forecasting the energy output of a solar system. And of course, as we just said, temperature is important. How hot is the day going to be in your region? But also, is there wind blowing, which is maybe cooling down the system? That might have a helpful impact on your efficiency as well. Something which is quite often forgotten, gets me every year, at least one day. It can make a huge difference of more than 10% in Germany, where we've got roughly 37,000 megawatts of wind of solar installed. And you get the first snow of the year in Bavaria, where the most solar panels are. You will always get it wrong, but at least this is something you should think about. And another example, which was quite interesting to follow up, was the solar eclipse, the partial solar eclipse we had in earlier this year. It was like roughly 70% of shading, so it was not a total eclipse, but a partial one. And it was interesting to see how everybody was failing in the market to predict the assumption or the amount of reduction right and correctly. The timing was no issue, but the amount, nobody got it right as far as I can remember, including us. If you think about our example I promised you with the coal-fired power plants, the supply side does not start where you've got electricity produced in your power plant and being ready to be delivered to your customers, but it actually starts when you start mining for that coal, which you need to run the power plant. What you see here is heavy floodings in Queensland, Australia, an area where there's a lot of mining activity going on, which then is exported to the whole world. And it's not only interrupting the mining, but it's also interrupting the transport from the mine to the port where it's being embarked to ships and then gotten to the destination. So there's a lot of things which can go wrong even before you start producing what you want to sell or want to get to your customers. And there's also, of course, other things you could imagine. If you think about the Texas coastline, where there's a lot of oil and gas drilling going on, the next hurricane that will move in will interrupt the production here at least for a couple of days. Excuse me. And same goes with storms in the North Sea and interrupting gas drilling in Norway, which is quite important for the European market. But it can also be that the heavy rains which such storms bring could interrupt hydro generation because you get almost equal levels before and after the dam, or you need to spill your water because you can't produce anymore. This is something you should keep in mind as well. There's a lot of stuff related on the supply, not only when it comes to the direct generation of power or liquefying natural gas or whatever, or refining oil, but a lot of things can go wrong beforehand. And the earlier and the better you know, the better off you are in the market. Coming from one extreme to the other, that was the extremely hot and dry summer of 2003 we had in most parts of Central and Western Europe. I think France was even more heavily affected than Germany was, but even here you could see it. This is where our office is based. It's Düsseldorf in Germany. Usually there's ships floating around and a lot of cargoes bringing in coal from the ports in Rotterdam to the coal-fired power plants. It was obviously not possible to do so in this summer. So this is the other extreme, which you should keep in mind as well. A different story with this hot and dry summer was that the water of the rivers was not only used for transportation of your commodity to your power plant, but of course you need the water itself, as Laurent put out earlier already, to cool your power plant, especially the nuclear ones which are close to the rivers. If there's either not enough water in the river to do so, or if the water is so hot, warm, that you can't cool down efficiently anymore, you need to reduce your conventional production as well, which is probably something which is not too obvious if you think about weather impacting supply side. So that needs to be taken into account as well. So overall, you can say that the tasks for meteorologists in the energy sector are ranging from very nearest term or intra-hour forecasting to balance the grid, to long-range forecasting, especially when you're working for a utility-based with assets, which probably wants to hedge future losses and sell forward. It's the example Laurent gave with the hydro plants. Are you willing to run your plant now, or do you want to do that later on? That holds true not only for hydro plants, but basically for every power plant, because you need to make up your mind what the future's conditions going to be, especially for weather. Will it be a cold winter, a warm winter, a hot summer, a dry summer? And the earlier and the better you know that, the more easy it is for your company to make money out of this. With this, I think I've covered the supply side for now. Are there any questions before we move on? The longer-term outlooks for solar, it's more a rule of thumb. So if you expect, for example, the summer to be very hot, you will probably have sunny conditions mostly, which means in general, even though you've got hot temperatures, there will be a lot of solar production. On the other hand, if you're expecting a very mild winter, it's usually coming with high low-pressure activity, which means it will bring wind and lower solar generation. So you can take it into account to some extent, but not completely. Well, in this case, we'll move on to the next extreme, or to the next end of the chain, and that is the demand side. Whenever supplying your product, be it electric power or oil or gas, this is what you tend to meet in the end, the demand in your region. And I want to start again with a quite obvious example. This is correlated the Scandinavian consumption temperature in blue versus the power demand in the Nordic region in red. First thing you see, it's quite obvious that it's a counter movement. You know, temperatures go up and demand goes down, and the other way around. And there's another thing I want to draw your attention to, and that is that we don't have any secondary peak in summertime. It's something which is particularly true for the northern countries, be it in Europe or in the US or anywhere else. As long as you don't have a massive installment of air conditioning, which is getting your demand up in summertime, this is how a typical profile looks like. It's daily data, so what you can also see is that you always have those small gaps in the demand on the weekends, plus the holiday season, which is occurring here. So you can almost be certain that most shops and everything in Scandinavia is closed mid-July to end of August. I've been there once. Now, on the other hand, and that's the next example coming from France, you see that, first of all, also the French like their holidays. That's this dip. But secondly, and more important, there's a small increase of demand at the beginning of summer. So when it's getting hot, France is one of the examples in Europe, at least, where you see enough air conditioning being installed right now that the demand is increasing, even though the temperatures are increasing, which would you not expect in the Nordic region. And the example we have here for the other extreme, that's actually from the United States, it's northern Texas. The data is from ERCOT, friendly provided, and you see that in general those two lines are in parallel. Demand is following temperatures, unless it's really, really cold in winter. That's the minor spike I indicated. But I'm not an expert in the US markets, but I think this is quite a good example of how things work here. And that's so far relatively easy to follow up. Something where it is a bit more obvious when you use another commodity, not power, but gas, which is used massively for heating in the United Kingdom. You see here the demand for gas to heat, local distribution company gas demand, and temperatures. The temperature is up by like 6.5 degrees, and your demand is decreasing by roughly 1/3. And this shows you how well those two are correlated. And the earlier you know such cold spells in winter, because we're talking about a winter phenomenon here, the easier it is for a supplier of gas to buy the gas when it's still cheap and then have enough gas to secure supply during cold events. It's a bit more tricky to get the impact of light on the consumption behavior, right? So I used power demand and solar generation in Germany as an indicator for this. Of course, solar generation is much better when there's a lot of sunlight going out down. And with a lot of sun, you usually have more outdoor activities. And of course, if you're outside, you don't use electricity. So if your solar generation is down significantly by 2,000 megawatts, roughly, your demand is up by 1.4, roughly. Yeah. So it's not a perfect match because there's other factors coming into the equation, but at least it's we're comparing business days and not holidays, and it should give you an indication which should be reflected in thinking about meeting the demand as well. I don't know. Maybe we can do a quick summary. So you've got a lot of influences on the supply side with temperature. It's particularly the influence on the plant efficiency and, of course, on the need for heating. No heating without electricity, even though you might run it on gas, it still needs some power. And, of course, it has an impact on melting of snow. Will there be run-of-river production? Will there be cooling water available again? So on and so forth. You got solar generation, which obviously is triggering solar generation. Same with wind, but also with wind, it's the wave heights, it's the circumstances under which you can still drill for oil and gas on your platform or not. And of course, with precipitation, it has the most impact on hydro generation, but it also defines your snow reservoir you build up during winter, which then is available the next spring and summer. And of course, on river levels. Energy demand, it's more the heating and the cooling affected by temperatures. With solar radiation, it's more the consumption behavior. If you're inside, you need light. If you're outside, you can't use electricity from the grid. Wind, I would say I couldn't imagine any major influence on the energy demand, but if you think of something, please let me know. Precipitation, again, it's more the consumption behavior, how you spend your leisure time rather than any direct impact. Was that what you were expecting? Did you think of anything else? Are you surprised by something? Go ahead, please.
Well, okay, that works. I admit I was a bit surprised about one general flavor I got from your talk. I'm used to talk to traders in their day ahead and intraday activities very much, so I expected more talk about wind and solar viability and the trouble you have in the day ahead and intraday and reserve power and so on. Your focus was more about long-term activities. Does that reflect that that is of higher priority? Why have you chosen that part of your
Because it'll be part of the next thing with the energy markets, I think.
Okay, so split in terms of the agenda. Okay, good. And in your daily life at Aon Global Unit Trading?
It depends. In my personal life, it's more the longer-term stuff because I'm focusing on hydro forecasts for Scandinavia. But, of course, we're doing short-term wind and solar forecasting as well, but it's done by different colleagues, so it's not what I've chosen. Well, that's where I came from, but I then switched over, and I think the long-term stuff has a bit more potential to show these interconnections and how things work together. You don't mine coal the hour before it's in the plant, so it's a bit more easy to explain.
Okay. Good, thank you.
I have the microphone.
Thank you. You showed the picture of the flooded coal mine, but there isn't much on events in this diagram. So I can think of things like ice storms bringing down power lines and floods disrupting transportation or transmission and the drought that you showed. So how significant is that, and how does that fit into this this analysis?
I would say it's relatively extreme events, that's true, but they have a big impact on markets. So I think it's a good example to choose if you want to show that something which you might know a bit earlier than your competitors can decide on whether you make a lot of money or you lose a lot of money in the market. That's why I touched on that.
Do we have any additional question at this stage? No. So, go on.
Okay. Thanks a lot. So in this case, we will move on and go a little bit deeper into the energy markets. In general, you can say that if an event tends to be very close to seasonal average, if it tends to be very local, it has a low impact on power prices. The more extreme things get, and the larger the area is which is affected, the higher the impact is. For example, if you got a small area of thunderstorm activity, it's probably more an issue for the grid operators rather than for the energy markets. They will be busy, the energy market won't. On the other hand, if you've got ongoing El Niño conditions and a lot of floodings in Australia, this is something which will affect the whole globe, everywhere where coal is consumed and needed. You will feel it, and I will give you an example for that later on. So it's always important to understand which time scale and which regional scale we are talking about, and the lead time you have to forecast such an event. In general, the earlier the better, and the more accurate, of course, the better off you are. So you are in a position where you can give a good advice and put traders to the right direction, or hedging, or whatever part of the game, and also take into account the region where your event is taking place. If you're talking about droughts or heavy rain, it might be less of an issue in Germany compared to Norway, which is more than 90% depending on hydro generation, for example. So this is an impact as well. And you also should take into consideration what your status quo is. Are you starting from very, very dry soils, which can't take any water if it comes in because it's too dry? Are they just enough dry to get a little bit of that away out of the equation, or are we starting in a situation where we already have very much water, then anything which comes on top is worsening things. This is now more into the markets, and I think what you said, Marion, we are talking about the day-to-day changes, so I've chosen two examples. In the UK, the gas price versus the temperature. On the one hand, first example, you've got a temperature decline of almost 3 degrees, and your price is up by 30 pence per therm. And on the other hand, if your temperature increases in a short period of time, especially in a shoulder month like April, where the level of switching your heating on and off is very close together, you can see that it has a huge impact there as well. So this is probably what you meant when you were talking about these shorter term things. Again, this is daily data, so it's maybe not as easy to see in the graph, but the numbers are there in any way. Maybe a bit specific, and that's why I think it's worth mentioning, and that's renewable generation in Germany. As probably many of you know, there's this feed-in tariff for renewables in Germany, which was set up by the government some years ago in order to subsidize renewables and get them into the market, which was obviously a success. And with this, you've got a sort of priority for renewables. So if there's wind blowing and if there is wind generation, it needs to be taken into the grid, full stop. So you ramp down any other power plant in order to get the supply and demand balance right again. It's holding true for wind and solar. We start off with wind. You can see German base price at even negative levels on Christmas Eve 2013, where we had record high wind generation of almost 22.7 gigawatts. And on the other hand, just some 13 days before, we had almost no winds blowing in the German areas, and we had a base price which was 70 euros higher. Another example of strong winds on the 22nd of December 2014 was not negative by that time, but at least almost close to zero. And this is, of course, something which is very important for our short-term traders and the planning. Because the worst case scenario is you've scheduled a power plant and you're reaching negative prices. Shouldn't happen. Next example, which is more or less the same thing is with solar. You are looking at the German power price for the day ahead, peak generation versus the German solar output. I've chosen a very low example on the 11th of December versus a scenario with good generation and negative prices on the 16th of June. It's getting a bit more interesting when talking about precipitation. Precipitation has different impacts on markets. I've chosen Scandinavia because they are very, very weather and hydro dependent in particular. And when precipitation comes down, it usually doesn't have an immediate effect. It takes some time to get the water being collected by the small flows into the bigger rivers where you've got your power plant, so you've got a lag effect of a couple of days. It can get lost on the way. It can either get to the soil and be stored there. It can evaporate if it's hot in summer. So it doesn't equal out one to one. But still, the direction is clear. What we will do is, or what everybody does actually, is that you define certain areas and you look at the installed capacity of hydro generation in this area. If it rains in that area, you can say that this precipitation amount should be connected to the installed capacity, which gets you a feeling and a number for the precipitation energy, which is coming down, which is a matter for our business. And when doing this, you can see that if there's a lot of precipitation energy coming down, like between the 8th of April and the 19th of April, you see the spot price on L-spot going down from 58 to 37 euros. And on the other hand, if there's a dry period like March 2013, you've got a significant increase of prices. But it takes a couple of days. That's something which you can see if looking in the data in a bit more detail as well. And then again, with hydro, you should distinguish between run-of-river production, which you have immediately once your water reaches the river your plant is located at, and between storage and reservoirs, where you can decide and optimize if you want to run your plant now or you're going to keep your water. Maybe you have regulations that say you need to keep the water, so you're not as flexible there as with other stuff, and but at least much more than compared to a run-of-river. Coming back to the example we had with the floodings in the Australian coal mining areas, you see here the price for coal, which is leaving Newcastle port, free on board Newcastle. That's the definition of the price. So that means the coal has been transported to the port, it's on the ship and ready to be sold anywhere else. You can see that usually this FOB Newcastle price is very close to the API2 and API4, which is the price for coal heading towards Northern Europe, respectively for coal which is being shipped from Richards Bay in South Africa. In these events where the flooding was interrupting stuff in Australia, the price was significantly higher, and that's always a good indicator that something on the weather side has been happening there, because usually those tend to be in parallel. I think, again, that's what I wanted to mention with the impact on the energy markets. Of course, you could talk a lot more about energy grids, how difficult the task is to keep grids stable, but I won't touch on that in too much detail. I think this is what I wanted to say. Any questions on this part? Okay, not too many. So we're leaving the time frame of something between 15 and 30 days now, leaving the secure harbors of weather forecasting, going into climate assumptions. Before going on, let me ask you, who's fine with the assumption that the current warming we see is man-made and who is not. Who is? Hands up, please. Who's not? Oh, come on. You should be. You all know about the different time scales of weather and climate, of course, and that it's getting a bit more tricky to forecast these long-range events compared to the shorter ones. I want to come back to the greenhouse effect, which, and I think that was a question before, unfortunately the gentleman has left, so anyway, this is what we have and have had for a long period of time already, the natural greenhouse effect. You got shortwave radiation coming in, it's being conversioned into heat, and you got longwave radiation going out or hitting the atmosphere, which warms up and sends something back to you as well. Now, without this, our global average temperature wouldn't be plus 15 degrees, but minus 18. So it's a good thing we have it, and it's probably for a good purpose. But by increasing, especially methane, carbon dioxide, and such stuff in the atmosphere in a heavy extent and in a time scale, which so far I think is has not been occurring on the planet, we are triggering something which is going into the warmer direction very rapidly, which is something we as the whole sector will have to cope with because it does have many effects. This is what would happen if you just increase the temperature, the average temperature over a year by a certain amount, say 2 degrees. You would probably all say that 2 degrees, that's not too much, you could easily handle that. But where the real problem is that certain events on the cold end become statistically completely unlikely. And on the other hand, the risk of really, really hot events, which has been not likely to occur beforehand, now pops up with a bigger than zero number. And this is where the real problem begins. So what you see here is not the temperature itself over a year, but the distribution of the probability for a certain temperature to occur. And with a higher mean, you're losing cold events, but you're gaining really hot events, and you've got a significantly higher amount of warm to hot events as well, which is, if you remember our talks about temperature impacts on supply and also on demand, a problem, because if you're thinking about these really cold events, you would say, okay, for an energy sector or a company working in the energy sector, it shouldn't be a big problem. There's higher demand, we can sell more of our products, so we are fine, we are happy, and usually we tend to be able to meet the demand. Now, on the other hand, if you've got very hot conditions, you not only have higher demand with increasing air conditioning being installed, but you also run into a situation where you've got generation problems, you're losing plant efficiency, you're having cooling power problems, you might not be able to embark your coal to your power plant, your solar cells are losing efficiency. A very high scenario usually comes with low wind, so you've got demand increasing, but generation decreasing, and the more extreme this event gets, the bigger your problems are, and same holds true, by the way. Sorry. For the power lines which are transporting your power, sorry, could anyone give me some water, please? Thank you. Well, that's one thing to think about. On the other hand, when coming to precipitation, the second one, which will obviously change, is that if you've got slightly higher precipitation over the year, it's not such a big issue overall. It's the distribution, again, which making the difference. And here again, we are gaining ground on two extremes, and that's a big problem. Either we've got way too Thank you very much. Too kind. Way too much water. In this case, you're running into the problems of spillage. You've got floodings, transportation problems, mining problems, everything which is correlated to it. And on the other hand, if you've got not enough water, so the probability for those really dry events, which is increasing as well, you've got the other side of the handle. You can't cool your plants, you can't ship your coal, and you can't produce hydro. So again, this is something where just looking at the average value, which is changing a little bit over the year, does not make sense, but you need to look at the probabilities of certain events to occur or not to occur anymore. If you look at those things, you can say that temperature is probably more going to be an issue over summertime, while you've got precipitation more of an issue in winter. I've chosen France as an example because there are some numbers available. If you've got a peak demand increase of 400 to 500 megawatts per 1 degree warmer in summer, and then on the other hand, you're losing roughly 10,000 megawatts of production when it gets 7 degrees hotter, you can see that those are not working hand in hand to solve the problem, but they're adding up. And that is something you have to think about in the future. And on the other hand, if you've got warmer and wetter winters, you will have a decrease in demand. But on the other hand, your production is likely to drop as well, although I couldn't find any good numbers on the actually. You have some, Laurent?
Yeah, the actual, for the demand decrease, it's more than that. It's for 1 degree difference in temperature, demand decrease is more 2,300 megawatts.
Okay.
So this figure is a few years old only, but
yeah,
it has changed a lot. And about the production, no, I don't have any idea. Mm. But yeah, but the demand dependence has increased a lot.
Yeah. Thanks. So if you want to sum all this up and see how things are working out, you've got a present, which is as you know it, and a future scenario where you probably have a little bit less winter demand, but on the other hand, you also have less power generation depending on the type of power plant you're using in the future. And with increasing share of renewables, your production is probably losing even more ground. And on the other hand, we've got an increasing demand in summertime because there's more and more air conditioning being installed. You find your problems being summarized here. So there is a lot of challenges actually for the energy sector ahead, which are highly dependent on the meteorologist's input to this problem and the climatologist's input, and of course of the engineers to have the right decisions and come up with new ideas which are at least helping to solve parts of these problems. But I guess you won't be able to come up with everything, which means that in the future we are heading for some problems there. And the earlier you as a meteorologist can forecast all these things, the better off you are. The bigger is your margin, the lower are your losses, and the better you are hedged against future losses. This is, I think, what I wanted to say. So, thank you. I think I made up for part of the time. Any questions?
Well, thank you, Christian. So we have plenty of time for questions, comments, clarifications. Please, just introduce yourself.
Hazel Thornton, UK Met Office. Just maybe in addition to your last point about climate change and that some of the new work that's going on in the Met Office is all about high-resolution modelling and what can we say about thunderstorms under climate change, so particularly thinking about summertime. So in the summer, another additional bullet point could be stronger thunderstorms, i.e. increased risk of flash flooding, so short temporal rainfall.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more energy available to the system, so I think everything is going just a bit more extreme. You're absolutely right.
Other questions, comments?
Laurent, here's one.
Yeah, sorry. Russ.
Hey, I'm Russ Bigley from Excel, and I just wanted to know a little bit more about how are they determining the percentage of generation that's going to be affected, you know, due to warmer river water temperatures, and then also hydro.
Yeah, with warmer river temperatures, I think it's tough to get numbers. EDF probably would be the perfect source for that because you're running a lot of plants at your rivers and you should have the numbers. I can understand you don't publish them, but that's something which you could relatively well assess if you're at least working for a company which has this problem and you're not trying to do it from outside. With hydro, I think you can't say if amount of precipitation exceeds X, then we've got Y loss in generation because you need to take into account the, is it raining or is it snowing? If it's snowing, you obviously don't have any impact because it could rain or it could snow or not, but it doesn't make a difference. The state of the river or the reservoir prior to the event needs to be taken into account. Can you store it or do you have to produce right away or do you have to spill? And I think until too much rain becomes an issue for hydro generation, it takes a lot because then you need really huge areas being flooded. We had that a couple of years ago in Germany with the Danube River. There's a lot of runoff systems there. And of course, if your water levels are equal both sides of the dam, you can't produce anymore. But it takes a lot to get there. So for a lot of time being, I would say that if it rains a lot, you should be able to produce more, generally speaking.
Well, just to complement on what we have seen on climate change impacts, especially in Europe, the global trend is towards a drier situation around Mediterranean. And so both the hydropower production capacity should be reduced and the cooling capacity for power plants should be reduced as well. But of course, precipitation projections are a lot of uncertainty with them, and it's not easy at all to assess. But this afternoon, we'll have a presentation from Mathieu, who is working on the dimensioning of cooling systems for energy, for power plants, and I think he will say a few words about this. Some other questions? No? Yeah, Azel.
It's a bit about how sort of the fact that now the industry, especially in the UK, is privatised, how the question about obviously it's the natural grid works to have the lowest price for power at a particular point in time. Does it do anything about lowest price over the entire year? Obviously the people pay over, you know, they have a contract, so they actually care about the lowest price overall rather than the price on the day for the consumer.
Yeah, I'm not a real expert in the UK power market scheme, but I think it's not over a year if I'm right. I'm not an expert there.
Another question was about, it was actually a thought regarding your talk, was about hydropower and how do you use the water now or do you want to save it for later on? And obviously if they're owned by different people, the drivers aren't there to think in the long term necessarily unless they think there's going to be a real benefit. So in terms of the resilience for the country, it's a slightly different question to the time step for the profit for the individual companies. So I just wondered how, if that's thought about.
I feel like it doesn't make too much difference. I mean, if you want to optimize, you want to look ahead the most time you can get it right. It doesn't matter if you want to optimize from a country's perspective or from a company's perspective, I would say. To come back to this example with the coal-fired power plant, for example, if you're building or deciding to build such a power plant, the worst thing for you to happen would be that you have a power plant running the next 5 years, but you don't know if you can really deliver power to the people in 2020 and make money. So what you do as a producer is you sell forward. So you say that there's a price on energy which is being delivered due to delivery in 2020. It's probably lower than what it will actually be in 5 years, but nevertheless, you want to take out that risk from the equation, you want to hedge against it, and you want to sell forward. Now, if prices are higher, it might be an idea to say, well, it was a wrong decision. I should have not sold forward, but I should have waited and then produced when prices are higher. But maybe you're lucky and there's electricity needed in France because there's a cold wave and you can export from Germany to higher prices in France. And so I think there's a lot of things interconnecting here. It cannot that easily be answered.
Any final question? No, everybody's starving. So it's time for break, I guess. Thank you again, Christian.
Thank you.
For your talk. So we now have the lunch break, which will be in the garden just outside. You can go through this door. We will reconvene at 1:45. Please remind that we'll have a final question and answer session, discussion, and so on. Please already think to issues you would like to raise, comments you'd like to make, and if you have some specific subjects you'd like to be discussed, you can either keep it for later or come and talk with Marion Chodam-Scheidt, who is there, and myself, raise your issues, and we'll try to accommodate for them during the discussion. Thank you for your attention, and hope to see you again in 1 hour and a half or so. Thank you. Enjoy your lunch.